Blog Talk Radio.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stone, immaculate. Now listen to this.
Back in New York, and back on the eve of a full moon, it is summertime, ladies and gentlemen, with your host, me, Filippi. And that's the way it's going to be. Professor Val and I have reached an accord, and she has decided to take a leave of absence from the airwaves for a while. I don't know if it's permanent, but the paint is drying. So we're going to do a couple different things in our opening segment here, and we have our guests come on at 9:10. I want to get you guys alive from the beginning. I need some company up here in No Man's Land. Phone number is 646-478-4847. Tonight we're talking about that dirty word, recovery. Not addiction, recovery. And we have a really good guest coming in. Hopefully she'll call, because otherwise it'll be a really interesting show. Just me talking to myself. And we're going to go over some of the newfangled ways that recovery is being achieved out there in Somaliland. So the number again, 646-478-4847. Do you have someone in your life that's walking around recovering from something? And it could be addiction. It could be a loss. It could be from the stock market. I don't care. Same formula here. And we're going to get into some interesting things about the way that you perceive yourself and the way that others perceive that perception. So we're going to get a little Hall of Mirrors discussion with this a little bit with our special guest, Dan Thompson, from cultureofrecovery.org. I think it's an org. So, but first things first, I have a little song I like to play that sort of summarizes where I'm at with this stuff. We've been doing this show almost 2 years to the date. I think we started in April of 07, around there, in a really nasty little radio station over there on the campus of Manhattanville. Before there was like a giant flood. It was amazing. That whole spring was amazing. And those were happy times. And we had myself and Professor Val and Brother Jeb up there with his country wellness. And we did a different kind of show back then. You know, and the show and this Blog Talk Radio platform has really evolved in the last 2 years to the point now where I don't even understand how it ever was in the pupa stage that we got on board a couple of years ago. But I know, I figured I'd dig around, find a song that just kind of sums it up. And when you think of me, and you think of this work, and you think of what goes on here on this dopey show every week on Wednesday night, just you want a kind of song in your head, kind of just to kind of summarize it. So I fished around and I found this.
Some people call me the space cowboy, yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice, 'cause I speak of the pompousness of love. People talk about me, baby. Say I'm doing you wrong, doing you wrong. Well, don't you worry, baby, don't worry, 'cause I'm right here at home.
Everybody!
I'm a thinker, I'm a grinner, I'm a lover, and I'm a sinner. I play my music in the sun. I'm a joker, I'm a smoker, I'm a midnight toker. I sure don't want to hurt no one.
All right, we're back in Eco Land here on Summer Space. Everybody grooving. There we go. All right, we'll hold that to the end. We have a special guest joining us now from an undisclosed location. Are you there, caller?
Yes, I am.
Joining us live from her babysitting chores in New Rochelle, we have my daughter, Sarah Jane Filippi. Thanks for joining us tonight here on Samba Time.
You're welcome.
Well, I found you're welcome. All right, so give us an update. What's going on in both games?
The Mets have bases loaded with no outs, and it is...
And we got a Philo up here. I think Delgado's up, the Philo.
Uh-huh, 3-2. 3-2 count. Get away. And it's 2-4, Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
And...
So we have an Eco on the mound for them. Pitcher for the Reds?
Huh?
The pitcher for the Reds looks like an Eco from here.
Well, I'm not looking at him. It's Jerry Manuel.
So look at him now, right there.
Oh, he's
crazy
looking.
Flaming Eco. Look at him. He's got a blue eye in front of his head. There's an auto there. I don't know who that guy is. But anyway,
the Yankees is a commercial. So.
Well, they're getting killed. They're losing like 7-1.
Oh, last time I checked, it was 5-1.
Okay. Did you hear about the?
Oh no! Yeah, 7-1, 7-1, no outs. Top of the sixth, and I think it's Jeter.
So then
Robinson Cano. Robinson Cano, and they have someone on the second.
So what happened with the Phillies today? They come back and win that game?
I don't know. I didn't watch that game.
Well, because they were losing 10-3, and then they came back and they were winning.
I'll look.
Oh, you're gonna look?
Wait, no. I can't look.
I'm gonna look. Oh, Delgado, foul. So we got a little summer cast going on here because it's the beginning of the baseball season, and, you know, Bean's all set for our first trip to Citi Field on Mother's Day. And I heard that Flat Earth Dave Butler's going next Thursday.
Really?
Citi Field, yeah. A Yankee fan, no less.
Actually, the Cardinals are losing right now to Pittsburgh.
Well, I'm looking up the Phillies. Oh, look at this. Down 7 in the 7th, Phillies beat Braves 12-11. Rat bastards.
Marlins won.
Yeah, Marlins are 3-0. Wow. So do you have any favorite players for the new team this year or what?
Santana.
You're sticking with Santana? Your Philo?
Mm-hmm.
Your Philo?
Uh-huh.
What do you think of some of the new guys they got? Like Sheffield, they're the old Yankee. You don't like him, huh?
Okay. Well, I hate that guy that I don't know his name. Oh, the K-Rod guy? I hate him.
Well, tell me why you can't stand him. That's ridiculous.
Because he reversed Santana's numbers.
Yeah, because he's number 75 and Santana's 57.
I don't like him.
Okay. Well, he's an Eco. It's a fair fight. You don't like him. It's okay.
I don't care. I don't like him.
Oh, well, ground ball. That's going to get a run home.
How is yours faster than mine?
I don't know. I got business cable. I got to tell you. So now it's second and third, one out, Mets down by a run. You fooled them on the pitch, too. Damn.
Actually, they haven't updated this thing yet. The thing that's up right now, the score,
that's right.
Whatever.
They're doing that big, well, that starts in June, but they start...
No. It just said, in the middle of, an inning, it'll pop up and it'll be like, oh, Mets, and they'll show how many hits and runs and errors.
Oh, right.
And they didn't update it. It still said 2-4. It was 3-4 now.
I just scored it 2 seconds ago. What do you want? So it's Beltran now. Beltran batting behind Delgado, huh?
Uh-huh.
Well, keeping the Eco in there. That ball outside.
Ew, I'm watching right. MLB Network.
So, you're not watching MSNY?
No, I just switched it to MLB Network to see if I could try and find the Phillies, but I didn't switch it back.
12-11. I mean, I heard that they walked in like five guys, the Braves. Thinking Braves. I mean, I hate both teams, but, you know, whatever. So we got Easter coming up. What's the situation looking like weather-wise? And as far as... Wait a minute. We got two runs coming in. Slough hits the mound. And they score. Now
that's
right. 5-4.
That's Beltran
right. With a little laser up the middle. So we got...
He doesn't have his mole anymore on his ear?
Are you kidding me? They cut the mole off his ear?
Oh, wait, maybe it's covered. Maybe it's covered with that
thing. It's under the flap on his helmet. I think it's on the right side of his face.
Oh, man.
Wow. So the Mets got three runs in this inning. Look at that thing. Right up the middle, he hit it. Oh, right up the middle. Look at that pitch was. Wow. So let's get into Easter mode here. What's the situation going on as far as...
I don't know what the weather's supposed to be like. I think it's supposed to be nice, but we're going to Wawa and Kangi's house.
Yes, I understand. And as far as the egg situation going, we have the
We're coloring eggs on Friday,
right.
And we're knocking eggs on Sunday morning before we go.
All right. And then this year, of course, Kyle loves the knocking of the eggs. He doesn't care. I think last year
it's
I won.
Fun.
Didn't I win last year?
I think
I beat him at the end.
I think you beat him. I don't remember who
won. I think I had a cool at the end and outlasted him. So we'll see. So what are we eating now? What's the menu? Because I'm going to be asleep the entire time.
Ham.
Ham, yes.
Ham. Ambrosia.
Ugh.
Mommy's making potatoes and asparagus and
right.
Probably sausage bread.
There you go. I got the sausage bread in there. All right.
I'll make it. Mom's going to be like, hey, why didn't you make it?
All right. As long as I'm back for the Ranger game, I won't be too upset.
Well, Mom said that she's like, oh, well, we have to be back early because I have school the next day. Because she has school.
You're off on Monday, right?
I know I'm off, but we're going to go. I'm going to work
and
with her.
And Kyle's off all next week, right? Just so I know this?
Uh-huh.
There.
Yeah.
My life is ruined. Okay. All right, well, happy Easter, and we will get ready for that this weekend, and good luck watching the Mets try to bring this game in now. We got some runs. We just got to get to the bullpen and see if we can get the 2-0 and keep
wait,
the Phillies.
Wait, I'm
going to
try to find
the
Phillies score.
They won 12-11.
Oh.
They scored, I don't know how many runs that inning. They were up 11-10, and then the bullpen must have got them tied, and then they won it 12-11. But
Yankees are losing 7-2 with someone on third, and whoever's number 12 is up.
They can't lose enough. Then did you hear about the whole Jabba thing?
No.
The whole drunk driving thing with Jabba, and he said that New Yorkers were rude and all that stuff.
Mm-mm.
It's all over YouTube. Check it out. All right. Well, thanks for joining us for the Easter update. We're going to turn attention now to Canada here, and our guest is here. So if you want to say anything out to the summertime audience before you go, wish them a happy holiday or something. Or
happy Easter.
There you go. All right, Bean. Thanks for joining us. We'll get you on again for Mother's Day,
maybe. Excuse me, that's not my name. My name is Sarah.
That's right. That's right. Sarah Jane Philippi, and off the air known as Bean Head, but she's getting herself
well, now it's
ready for
on the air because you said it.
Well, now it is. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we'll get you back on to talk about Citi Field when we go in a month.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Bean. Thanks for calling in.
My name is Sarah.
Okay. Love you. Bye.
Love you too. Bye.
All right. There you go. All right. There's my daughter filling some time. Thanks a lot. All right. We have our guest here. Whoops. She just dipped out on me there. And our guest is here. She found us in the right time zone and all that. Ann Thompson, how you doing tonight?
Yeah. Do I have to do a – am I on now or do I
you're
have
on,
to –
You're on the air. Well, officially, not quite yet. 1 second. There it is. The sound of the Soma submarine leaving the port. As we kind of go below the surface of where people live. So we're just getting into this topic of recovery here. We're just doing a little bit mentioning what happened in the news today with, I don't know if you saw it up there in Old Canada, but one of the budding stars on the Yankees, Jabba Chamberlain, who was arrested for drunk driving, I guess about 5 months ago. YouTube video surfaced of his arrest and comments he made and things like that. He was actually found in the car, drunk, drinking a Crown Royal. So if we're not drunk enough, we're now actively drinking the Crown Royal while we're driving.
While driving.
That is an advanced level
drinking.
Of drunk driving. Yes. Yeah. And his comments were New Yorkers are rude and Yogi Berra is short. That was basically what came out of that discussion. So in the population known as the recovery movement, which is, to me, an oxymoron, but maybe you can clear that up for me. The phrase living in denial comes up a lot as someone slides from abuse into addiction, and there's that moment of, where you have to confront this, that this is not just something that you're doing to relieve stress. You're actually going to go there anyway. So just give us your you have a very eclectic history. I searched all over the place on the web, found you in just about every nook and cranny, but not one place. So for the audience listening, who is Ann Thompson, and how did you get here?
So So which do you want me to? I'd much rather comment on the first what we're talking about recovery than about myself.
Well, just about your history.
I'm a person with lived experience in terms of mental health issues. I hate labels, but I will say I'm a survivor provider. So I've had experience. With mental health issues, and I'm also, my recovery journey was about going to school, and I'm actually a social worker now, and really I'm a recovery educator. So that took about 7 years to get to where I am right now, and I'm very interested in exploring non-medical model alternatives to mental health. Natural ways of for folks to be able to what we call personal medicine, ways that you can help yourself in terms of your challenges, whether it's mental health issues or substance use issues or whatever.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Punctuated by the word whatever.
What you started out with, you're talking about around a recovery. I think the first question was around recovery from an addictions or from a substance abuse.
Yeah, we mentioned top of the show that recovery is a process that covers any number of human events,
exactly.
A to Z.
Yeah.
I mean, you could be recovering from a cold. I mean, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What people tend to associate when someone says I'm in recovery is they associate it with addiction to chemical substance or recreational drugs, whatever.
That's where the word has been most. I think I'm not saying that it came from there, but when we talk, we might say recovery, but really when you see the literature, it's mental health recovery. We always put that piece. That piece in front of it, but you're definitely right. It's recovering from any kind of an experience where you've gotten to a place where you, you're overwhelmed and you're not sure whether it could be a physical health issue, cancer, loss, whatever. And what do you do to come back from that, but to be able to, to go beyond and have a meaningful life after you've had, like, really a life-altering experience. So.
Yeah, and again, the popular wisdom, I guess you call it, I don't know if it's conventional anymore, is that people don't recover from certain things, that they're always in recovery, they never get out. And that, I guess that ethos, if you want to go through 12 steps, or you want to go through cancer, or, that five-year window with cancer. I had cancer when I was in my 20s, and they tried to run that junk on me. And and for the most part, it's not a very empowering model. It's a model of surrender, especially the 12-step program because of the spiritual overtones to it.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, it not only has it gained traction, it's become the gold standard, and then they expect, it's a relapsing condition, but they expect people to just fail at it over and over again, almost to the point where that becomes their life. Their life becomes going to meetings and then relapsing, going to meetings and then relapsing.
Mm-hmm.
And never getting to the point where they can actually see a different identity behind that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
What has your work been doing to sort of give people another road here?
To try to challenge that? Well, primarily to what in the recovery literature, mental health recovery literature, that word is a very it's not a particularly good word. Most of us are not. Happy with that word because it simply doesn't capture the experience. And what folks will talk about, and certainly survivor doesn't either, and I've got to say that, it's one piece of it, but that word was never, it's a label, it's certainly a label for some. I liked recovery better than survivor, but recovery,
right.
Folks talk about, they'd rather use the word discovery, it like finding themselves, or the word that you see more and more in recovery literature now is transformation, which really talks about change, the possibility for change, because we really talk about we've had this life-altering experience, we're not the same people as we were, and who knows quite frankly, who and what we are going to be mm-hmm. as we work our way back from that experience. So,
well,
but it's going
transformation
beyond.
Is kind of a trigger word here, so I'm just going to give you the trigger answer.
Yeah.
There it is. Anytime a word becomes a buzzword on this show, we tend to get the UGG out. Because
transformation now, too.
Yeah, right. It becomes a Smurf word. It means too many things in too many contexts, and it sort of loses its juice. It's kind of like the gum loses its flavor. So we like to talk about coherence on this show mm-hmm. and how people get to a sense of coherence, especially when you're dealing with people recovering from anything that has to do with the disruption of their connection to their surroundings. And that's the organic nature of what you're trying to get at, and that is sort of inorganic when you deal with, oh, it's a genetic predisposition. Oh, it's a family history. Oh, it's something you can't put a fork in. And people just walk around saying, well, I'm just broken, and I'm just, I'm just tainted, or I'm just, left with this thing. How do you get the sort of the educators on that front line that are promulgating that model to even listen to something 180 degrees to it like this is?
Well, it's interesting because I just finished working with a group of providers all day today, and what I do, and I do the same thing, I do work with families as well, and I start out right from the very beginning, and I say, I'm going to bring you some information right now that I think is, I hope, and I don't say think, I hope you're going to be uncomfortable with this information.
Okay.
And I talk about, in psychology, there's a term called cognitive dissonance, and that's getting into an uncomfortable place. And if whatever the educational piece that I'm doing, if people will sit and listen and be there and we can all be respectful during that time, and if they can get uncomfortable with the new information that they get, in fact, people can and do recover from serious, from certainly in terms of mental health, most of the research, the longitudinal studies have been done with schizophrenia, so people can and do recover and have meaningful lives, and that's a very difficult message for people to hear. But
wait a minute. I want the audience to really soak in that and marinate that in a second.
Okay.
People, a large majority of people diagnosed by the allopathic side of the coin with this condition recover.
Yes.
They don't have it anymore.
I'm not saying don't have it anymore. What I'm saying is we'll be able to have a meaningful life by their self-definition, which means outside of the studies that I'm talking about right now, and there's a number of studies, are longitudinal studies, so they've been done over the last 35, 40 years, and they have there's a percentage anywhere from a little under 50%, like 46 to 68%. Those are the numbers that you'll see in the literature. Will have be out of the institution and will have meaningful lives, which means that they will work. They'll be able to have families. They'll be a part of the community, and it's that does happen. That happens. That message, majority of people, I don't think that they either have had an opportunity to hear that. I can certainly give you the websites. I have most of the research studies myself. I need that information. That's important for me. I'm one of those people who likes to know there was some research there on that as well. But also, just to share one other thing, a lot of people, they don't really care about the research. They want to hear personal stories. They want to hear somebody tell a recovery story, and that will be more powerful for them than seeing longitudinal studies or whatever else. But those are there as well.
Yeah, and this is what we call the moo, which is kind of the herd under the bell curve, and the woo, the people on the leading edge that are bringing in new truth, is sort of where the rubber meets the road, is that when you start thinking about recovery as a social process and not a purely biological process, where there's actually you're getting support from people inside and outside the circle, now you're talking about a whole different McGilla here. We're talking now all of a sudden here comes the 100th monkey, here comes all these other things are coming out of the bookshelves. And that really threatens the standard model, because the standard model, it studies the individual pretty much in a vacuum. and looks at environmental factors as sort of exacerbations, as triggers, as things that are going to make it worse. The environment could never support an individual in recovery, only make them worse. So it's almost like they try to, you know, they put you in rehab, they isolate you, and it's a very sort of like germophobic, people are bad, only individual doctors and things. It's like they put you in this almost like this lab rat mentality, and I don't know, has it worked?
Well, the it's the microscope is on the person and their problem, and individualized, and really particularly in mental health, and not the focus on being able to look at the other factors which are out in the, you know, in society and in well, cultural issues. Primarily, I know one of the questions that you had asked me to think about, and I mean, that, to me, this is a lead-in for it. It's can there? Some people say in recovery that you can't have recovery as long as there's the poverty issues, and there's a saying in recovery that what recovery is all about is a home, a friend, a job. So to be able to have housing, for some people, they'll have a complete recovery if they can get housing. They don't need anything else. They don't need anything else. There's research, you know, you'll see research on that. Other people will say...
There's hope for me yet.
other people will say you can't have recovery if you don't have your rights, without human rights, and that's the whole area of addressing discrimination. And so they'll say that as long as you've got a system that has seclusion, restraints, forced treatment, particularly around medications, that you're not going to be able to have recovery. So those are the cultural challenges for creating a culture of recovery that are very, you know, those are very huge, real issues for folks as well. So,
and again, this is that cusp of where language becomes important, where if they call alcoholism or drug dependency disease, and schizophrenia a mental illness,
yes,
what does that imply in terms of the way someone would go? Because again, the allopathic model. I mean, even like something like last week, they had Autism Day, happened to be out west in Denver, and they had a child life development conference going on there. And of course, everyone's running around with their puzzle pieces, and we're searching for this cure.
Mm-hmm.
And it's disease is not an entity, as what I was trying to get across to them. It's sort of the absence of well-being instead of the presence of well-being. So it's a little bit like, you know, when the sun goes behind the clouds, people just go, oh, there's no more light. And they don't accept the entire spectrum of human experiences being equal. Health good, disease bad. And they polarize it. And again, then they go on the attack, and everything becomes about sort of shoring up this weakened individual from the horrible, horrible, harsh world. And the argument about vaccines with they had on last week on Larry King about this autism debate, because our country has like almost three times as many, I don't know about Canada, vaccines that they could put these kids on a schedule on early on. In an effort to protect them,
yes,
you know, prophylactically protect them from being exposed to these things as they develop, and of course it ravages their immune system, and then we see the effects, you know, going out. So how do you do this with mental illness? Because again, you can't put a fork in someone's psyche; you can probably wound them without.
how do you get
to the point where it's not illness?
In recovery, mental health recovery literature, there is a shift. There's a paradigm shift going on, so a model shift, and it is away from an illness or a disease model. We simply don't talk about that. I mean, that's the language of a traditional medical model and the treatment that goes along with it, and in the recovery paradigm, we don't talk about that at all. We actually don't. We talk about the, you know, poverty, rights, how people have to, the issues around dealing with discrimination, and then how, in terms of the treatment piece, if you're not talking about a disease, what we talk about is how do we learn skills. And I don't like the word coping anymore. I've been kind of challenging around that word. It's about, we don't want to cope, we want to thrive. So it's much more, recovery is about prevention and mental health promotion. And mm-hmm. rather than the disease, which is kind of at the other end of the spectrum, we're talking about learning how to help ourselves when we get in incredibly overwhelming, stressful situations, and that most mental health issues, I don't believe they happen in a vacuum. I don't think it's like one day, you know, you're fine, and the other day, all of a sudden, you've got this. Well, I mean, that's my. I don't buy into the biological part of it and the genetic part of it. Maybe folks are predisposed to that, but I think that there's always something going on myself. I mean, from my own experience, hearing lots of other stories, there was stuff going on. People were in a place where they were having, you know, usually it's anxiety, then you get fear, and then you think you're going to lose control, and then you're. Then to me, that's what serious mental health issues come from, that kind of a context.
Mm-hmm.
And then how many, what are our skills around dealing with that? About, what we talk about, I facilitate a program called WRAP, which is Wellness Recovery Action Planning, and we talk about what are our wellness tools, what are the things that we know that we can use when we, and you explore triggers and early warning signs and things like that, and that's all about prevention. What are the things that we can do to help ourselves so that we don't get into that place? And so it's kind of on a continuum, and we want to be trying to, and, you know, as much as you can, but when you've got issues like poverty, or you've got, let's say, you know, loss, death, things that, you know, somebody very close to you, we're overwhelmed by. And quite frankly, look what's going on in the economy right now. People losing their jobs. There's, you know, talk about the mental health issues, are you going to look at that with what's happening with folks in the world today and say that's a disease when people start diagnosing it as depression and, I mean, those, it's or as a problem with you when we've got the kinds of things that are going on around us? I think we're going to see an incredible, I mean, it's already happening with people losing their jobs, losing their homes. You don't go for very long in that kind of a situation before you're, you know, if you want to take a look at it from a medical way, you're clinically depressed. And all
right,
of the other
again,
things.
This gets into that, again, that context of social individual where it'd be very difficult for the traditional model to have any traction if they adopted, like, I spoke last week at a conference about the first psychoanalyst, his name was Trigan Barreau, and he talked about role reversal a lot and how, you know, we're sort of conditioned into the asymmetrical relationships in life, whether it's parent-teacher, whether it's mother-child, or whether it's doctor-patient.
Mm. Yep.
And so the person goes to the therapist, and they adopt the persona, as he called it, the I persona,
yep.
of the client, and, of course, the doctor takes on the other persona. All he did was he had them switch chairs. And so the doctor sat and lay down in the patient's chair, and the patient sat in the doctor's chair,
mm-hmm.
and his biofeedback was, oh, my God, now I suddenly feel vulnerable, neurotic, uncentered, not sure of myself, you know, because the doctor has a very clearly defined role and the patient's sitting there in turmoil. So there's a physiological reality that a process model like you're talking about, where there's a constant conversation going on within the individual and between the individual and other individuals and then the entire culture at large, that has to be factored into any
mm-hmm.
health condition or any response to a life event, because that's how the system, it's almost like, you know, I try to give the analogy sometimes in somatics where it's like when you learn how to ride a bike, there was step one and step two and step three, but there was also, just like when you went from crawling to falling, that, you know, they're learning how to walk, there was a lot of noise. There was a lot of things to
yeah.
filter out. So you almost learn not to do the behavior in a way, and then all of a sudden you're
yeah.
doing the behavior. And that's
yeah.
what I think is missing from a lot of the recovery models I see out there, is that they just tell you, they do the Nancy Reagan thing, and then they say, you know, no drugs. We're just going to put you in a tank and detox you and then send you back on the street. And as some people around here have been telling me, it used to be 28 days. Now it's down to 14.
Oh, God.
Because the people, the places are too full. They're piling
yeah.
them up on the curb. So in 2 weeks, they're not even out of the last episode and they're back on the street, what do they learn out of that?
Yeah.
It's a revolving door.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I guess, maybe you have more experience with this than I do, because I kind of got kicked out of the club a while ago when the notion of stress addiction kind of came across the wire in the 90s when everybody was starting to take all the serotonin-based drugs and trying to mellow out. And so they had an outpatient program over here in New York, St. Agnes Hospital, and I got invited to speak about stress addiction. And I said, can we get out of the adjectives and just call them Addictions Anonymous? I don't care what your addiction is, because experience is really what you're having, and it's the quality of the experience that you want to improve, not the quantity, you know. And, of course, I said, you know, I used to crawl, and I gave a whole speech about I used to crawl before noon. I used to crawl alone. I used to crawl in the bathroom. You know, and it was like they thought I was mocking it. And I said, no, actually what I'm trying to show you is there's a certain disingenuous sort of almost kind of a classical model here where if I stop doing this behavior, I'm now a recovering blank, whatever I am.
Yeah.
But then I go in the back of the room, have a donut, a cigarette, a cup of coffee, and then walk out thinking I'm a recovering blank. To me, a little bit of a setup.
Yeah.
You know, the person then becomes something else. You know, then they're in another meeting and another meeting. It just it seems to be kind of a negation model is what I'm saying.
Yeah. And, we talk about needing to have the opportunity to actually learn from crisis. So for people not to be... to look at their experiences as we have to and believe that we will be able to learn from each one of those experiences. We'll be able to learn how to I don't like to use these words because they're medical model, like managing our symptoms or figure out how to minimize those. And hopefully along the way, we also learn some tools, some ways that are, it's challenging because when you found something that actually, I always say, talk about it's self-soothing. And it's about anxiety. It's about dealing with grief and pain and all of those things. And whatever it is that the way that we learn how to do it, whether it's with food, whether it's with alcohol, whether it's with drugs, whether it's with fantasizing and escaping, whatever it is, if we do it too much, then it becomes problematic. And and so we've got to try to find ways that are not going to be problematic and that we can get our wellness back. And that takes time, and we have to have experiences and hearing what other people, what's worked for other people as well. I see. Like my work, I do a lot of work. I really believe in self-help. I work in self-help groups and learning in groups, people learning from each other. And that piece is, I think that's really important too. And that certainly goes against there's not a lot of self-help in the traditional medical model. It's very much like that.
No.
What you described is you become the patient, passive, receiving, surrounded by professionals, but it becomes almost like learned helplessness. That's what we call it, call it in psychology. I think that the goal tends to be with the traditional system is about stability and maintenance and waiting until it happens to you again. And we're always talking about when are we going to stop looking over our shoulders and, wondering when we're going to be back in the hospital and when are we going to start looking forward to what's our life going to be about. You know, what could that look like? And that's a huge shift for people to make after they've been, they've been in the system for a while. So, and that's when being able to hear stories about people recovering and that really it's about hope. I mean, really, recovery is about hope for change, the possibility for change. And that's what challenges the medical model system for the most part. So,
and what we've seen, again, the self-help community has done, tremendous service and also sort of a quasi-disservice because the labeling process has continued. I don't know if you picked up on the notion of what a soft addiction is.
Well, tell me what you.
Well, there's a whole website that's dedicated to it. Basically, it's just about any behavior that you do that controls you, whether it's internet surfing or Twitter, you know. And you don't control it; it controls you. It becomes a soft addiction, which can lead to other addictions. And so it really comes out of the cycle of anything that's a habit that you're not conscious of that's controlling you, and you keep going to this outlet.
That becomes problematic for you.
And of course it's like they will take fingernail biting as a gateway behavior to heroin addiction if you listen to them long enough.
And so that
buzzword of addiction. Is such a in terms of what we look at, it has a powerful mimetic control over the way we think about ourselves. And then they identify themselves as an addict, and then they have the addictive personality disorders and all the other labels that the shrinks bring onto it. So your model, like I said, because it's about leverage and not labels, is to just take these imperfections that we have and look at them as survival mechanisms that have a very short-term use. And then they become low leverage. And so they don't give you a long-term solution. They give you a quick fix. And the more you rely on the quick fix, of course, the more you live in survival, guess what? Your standards are going to lower because you're not thinking about how this is going to affect my health in 20 years. You're thinking about, I want to feel good right now.
Yeah. Well, and quite frankly, in the medical system, the quick fix is the pill. And, you know, take the pill, and that will do it for you. And what we challenge with that is that's only one piece of this puzzle. You know, the big piece, as far as I'm concerned, is what we call personal medicine, and that's what we can do, you know, and it really is medicine. What are the things that we can do to help ourselves? And whether it's exercise or whether it's prayer or whether it's, you know, meditation or all of these things, they're very powerful. Those are the wellness tools. Those are the things that we, and to be able to recognize those as medicine, like actually, I mean, I'm using the word from the, you know, from the medical system.
Well, it's ingrained, I know.
But, and also the other piece that people, well, certainly up here in Canada, it's very hard to get what I like to call talk medicine, which is the opportunity to be able to talk, whether it's in therapy one-on-one or to be able to get into groups and to be able to talk, because that's where people, that's a healing, a lot of the healing, certainly if you can get into a place where you can talk about your experiences, then hopefully that we have to heal from the experience of discrimination as well and how we internalize that. And how do we get that opportunity when up here what's happening more and more, it's your connection with the psychiatrist is a 15 minutes med check once a month. And there's no relationship developing there. There's no opportunity and opening to be able to – and actually, I sometimes wonder, is there even an interest in finding out what's actually going on in somebody's life, you know?
Well, again, they separate you from – You said they don't even consider triggering events when it comes to depression.
Yeah.
It comes to they just look at that as incidental half the time.
Don't even explore that.
No,
yeah.
Because again, they don't have a map for it.
Yeah.
And if they did, their modality and their protocol would sort of like lose traction, because why are you going to stuff a bunch of stuff in my blood that deny me the experience my body is having, whether it's memory, whether it's inferred, whether it's imagined? No different than a kid experiencing a nightmare. You know, I think the coat over there is a monster. Well, you turn the lights on, kid. Okay, here, okay.
Yeah.
You know, support the environment rather than deny it. And to get them to do that, like I said, you have to close every, 24-hour drugstore and just people really want their surrogate realities. And it's one of the things I think in neurobiology they talk about. There's four basic drives, and they used to call them the four Fs, but it was fight, flight, feeding, and sex. And then they come up with the fifth one, which is bliss, which is the need to be high. And you could do that with endorphins from exercise, or a whole bunch of things that are healthy behaviors, but if we don't have them.
We produce it naturally.
Right.
I mean, the medications are really only trying to produce, they are mimicking what we do naturally within our own bodies.
Yeah, they're a cheap chemical substitute for what we naturally do. Like, you get endorphins from good conversation. You get all
laughing.
Those... Yeah, and
all of those we produce. So that's when I talk about. I mean, that's what personal medicine is all about. And between exercise and certainly, I mean, there are a number of them. And people are react differently to them. But we do that. That's. I love what you're saying there now because, you know, for me, what I really encourage people to think about is we create our own medicine. We, you know, we do that. And what's to say that, you know, where I'm challenged with the argument where quite often you'll hear people say, well, it's just, you know, a mental health issue is just like diabetes. Well, when you don't have insulin, you don't have insulin, and that's it. But I haven't seen the research that says we stop producing endorphins and we, you know, we're not producing dopamine or whatever else. I don't, you know, that piece is a huge challenge as far as I'm concerned to make that, you know, to be able to make that argument. But I don't. If we can produce it naturally, then you know, a good laugh and a good workout is just can make you feel. As I don't know about a medicine that can make you feel that good myself in the moment, and we can actually create that for ourselves right in the moment. So that's
yeah,
what
again,
we have.
And we've been talking with Dan Thompson from cultureofrecovery.org. And if you have a recovery story you want to share, got a couple minutes left here at 646-478-4847. And again, this is it's not exactly a revolutionary approach because so many other cultures understand this. It's our dopey drug-based culture that has to have some type of, I don't know, ritual to accept this.
Yeah.
And make it something, because if you deal with cultures that don't have access to our, you know, Western medical system, when someone is sick, it's almost like, you know, when a child is sick, they put the child on the belly of the parent, and basically the parent will support the kid through the fever, things like that. It's that communal aspect of healing. In somatics, they call it social coherence, where you couple with another person. You have limbic resonance and dyadic regulation and all that stuff that is really kind of, in the research now, it's kind of bound around that mother-child biological connection. But it happens all the time, especially happens in healing relationships with practitioners. I think sometimes the best therapy out there is these truck stop diners having a meal with your friend at 3 o'clock in the morning and getting a real heartfelt acceptance and being listened to and being heard and being seen. And a lot of times these poor people don't have that connection. They don't have a host of friends around them.
They're isolated. Yeah.
Right. And so what happens is it's just like if you moved to a foreign country and didn't speak the language, you'd feel separate.
Yep.
And when they're in that world, they don't feel like they can connect to you. Nothing relates. And it's a very physical, kind of obvious thing, but they've made it elusive, and they've made it sort of like, no, you can't define it. You can't tell me what it's about. We have to describe it through this filter, otherwise it doesn't happen. And I just don't know. You know, I guess we started from this point. We might as well kind of circle around and get it. Is that if you look at this thing as a series of obstacles and courses, what would be the number one cultural obstacle to creating that culture you're talking about, where all these labels and all these stigmas don't have as much appeal?
Well, I think that I talked about it earlier, and that's it's around what I had said was I thought around like a cultural obstacle would be poverty in my mind. I think that's a big piece, and again, it's and it's about rights as well, like our human rights, just as basic human beings. That when we don't have those things. Those are huge obstacles to for folks to be able to, to be able to get their wellness back.
And again, that's something that's completely disconnected from health and well-being is this notion of the economic terrain that we're living on. Especially now, it's become really obvious because my table's filling up with a bunch of guys living here in Westchester County that used to work on Wall Street. And they're not looking so good. It's like,
you know what I think is interesting?
Huh?
Maybe with what's happening in the world today and the economy, maybe we'll start to look at mental health issues – maybe we'll be forced to look at it differently, because are all of a sudden these folks who have had this thing starting to happen to them out in the world, are they all, is there suddenly an epidemic of depression starting to happen?
No, that just happened to them.
Is
there
an epidemic of anxiety, and we're all, it's in the water or something, and we're all getting that, but, you know, because it's happening because of what's going on out there in the world.
And that's something that, again, that I've seen it firsthand a couple of times in the aftermath of 9/11 here in New York.
9/11, exactly.
It was very prevalent, and it does have, I mean, even the autism thing, the Autism Speaks was organized because one of the senior people at NBC, his grandson had it, and he couldn't believe that there wasn't any research going on about it, and people were basically ignoring it, because the pediatricians, and this was came out in the interviews last week, they have a difficult time treating those children, because if the drugs don't work, they've got nothing to back it up.
They have nothing else. Yep.
And so they're out of guns at that point. So then they just throw up their arms and say, "Well, we can't handle that." And the parents are forced to scramble through. And we had an author on a couple months ago talking about they call them the alphabet kids, where there's about 70 of these different labels they give them, and they go through this myriad of services to attempt to kind of cobble together some type of a strategy. But the kid gets used to being, even the kid that's asthmatic, he can't play gym class. You know, all those labels that exclude. And so, you know, we try to say, you know, you base it more on, you take the limitation of the child and you make it a resource for the family. So everybody learns how to do breathing.
And it's for the rest of their lives, too. There are, in the mental health system, there are children being diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 2 or bipolar disorder. And, I mean, we also know, and being put on medications their minds or their brains aren't, you know, they can't handle those medications physiologically, and it's quality of life. It's the rest of your life, and you're getting a label at that point in time. I just totally blows my mind when I see what's happening for children, and quite frankly, it's the same thing at the other end with older people.
They do the same thing with Alzheimer's and all. Yeah, exactly. I mean, all of a sudden,
somebody who's made it through life and all the things that get thrown at them, starting to get older, losing physical control, and all of a sudden they're getting diagnosed with schizophrenia at age 70, and then being hit with heavy duty medications. That their bodies, it's the same as the children. You know, they're in a different place in terms of process of dealing with that medication, and it's the two places at early life and at the end of the life where we have the least amount of control over our lives, and that's where certainly what I'm seeing in some of the literature, one of the growing areas in terms of psychiatry is geriatric psychiatry. And it's not about therapy, about talk therapy. It's about, it's about medications that it's just.
Well, it's the same animal. They don't know how to. The drugs don't work. They put them in the nursing home, and a lot of times it's basics. It's just like with a child. You're dealing with, like, you know, electrolyte imbalances and breathing imbalances and postural problems that are you could hang a hook on them. It's so obvious. There's a scarcity of model instead of an abundance model. It's like
what is the treatment all about? I mean, quite frankly, it's when you talk about both children and seniors, it's about control, right?
Oh, totally.
You put them in the seniors' home, and you don't want them doing, you want them control what they're doing. It's about behavioral control.
Yeah, my mother's a nurse. They used to call them shut-up pills. I mean, basically, they give them a pill. They give them a Valium, shut up, and with the kid, they give the kid the neuropharmaceuticals, the Ritalin, and Ticalum. And again, there's such a polarization in terms of the, when you get, like, I've had MDs, on the show, and very, versed in that map. And when you confront them with that strategy, just like you did, I always ask them, well, what do you do if this doesn't work? And they They'll trail off. They don't know. So and then they go into percentages. Well, we get this many cases according to what family? According to because they'll extract it just like the addiction model. They're like, well, we got recovery from alcoholism, but that person became a diabetic. You know, it's all part of the same McGill. Same thing happened with AIDS. Same thing happened with all the other diseases in the last 25 years. They make a label. There's a groundswell because you can identify it by half a dozen symptoms, and then they start to bleed them all together, which is what we found in the Alphabet Kids book, is that there's such an overlap in these 70 neurobehavioral disorders that the author actually encourages the parents to get as many labels as possible so that they can continue to get treatment as they go through the system. Because if you just get ADD, you just get autism, and you just get Asperger's, well, they're going to limit your speech therapy here. They're going to limit your OT there. And you become it's like a million pieces instead of a whole person. You're treated by every little nuance, every little syndrome they could tag on you. And unfortunately for the masses out there, they don't have access as much to things like you're talking about. Where I'd love to see personal medicine on a major show like an Oprah or something like that, where people could actually this is something. Why not? You're right over there in Toronto. You can get to Chicago and just make this a case that. That people would understand on a grassroots level.
I think it's not rocket science. It's about getting back to our own about our own selves. And I mean, the question is, what is my role in this? To be able to ask, like, what is my role in getting my wellness back? And I mean, I asked. That's exactly the question that I asked. I've had two hospitalizations. They were short and brief psychotic breaks. At the end of the second one, I got the diagnosis bipolar disorder. This was 12 years ago, and I said to the doctor, I asked that was the first question I asked. What can I do to help myself? And he just looked at me. There was nothing. There wasn't any.
You might as well hit him in the head with a rock. I mean,
he said he wanted me to go on lithium, and he was waiting. And actually, I had read about it, and I said I was one of the. I'm just so lucky because I just had enough. I don't know what, because I hadn't talked to anybody else about it, but I just did not want to do that. I said, what can I do to help myself? And so what I did is I went right to the library and I read myself right through the entire psychology section of the local library, and I started to learn about cognitive behavioral therapy, and then I went back to school and did an abnormal psychology course and intro and learned about conditioning and started down the road of another way to look at this other than, than through medications. And that was the question, if I go on this and I was, for the rest of my life, how will I ever know what role I could play in helping myself? So,
you're living proof that this
I'm not the only one.
You're a great example of how someone who goes through it. I mean, again, I went through Sloan Catering here in New York City as a cancer patient, and I kept staring at them like, I got hit in the throat with a hockey puck. I don't know what you're talking about. And it was like, and I'm in a room with people 60, 70 years older than me who have, the voice boxes and all the other things going on. And I'm 20 years old, and I'm saying, I don't identify with this group. And the doctors, because of the diagnosis, that's what they treat. They're procedurally bound. So they don't perceive a whole person. They perceive a diagnosis that's married to a procedure that defines a condition that has a protocol, and that's the way they're trained. And in emergency situations, maybe that matters, but most of life is not emergencies. They make them sort of urgencies. You got to get your test for your colon cancer, and you got to get this, and your body becomes this attack machine that's just going to keep kicking out, biological noise from ancestors from 30 years ago. Yeah, so it's very 300 years ago. So I guess in closing here, there's a real kind of a wide view on the recovery model now out there with people dealing with grief counseling, things like that, a whole bunch of little niches out there. How do you envision this evolving in the next maybe 3 to 5 years or so as your movement kind of gets traction and people become more aware that there are other options? What do you think the next step's going to be?
Well, what I say is that all great movements, they're like 25, 30 years in the making, okay? what's been happening with recovery, the research, there's a solid research base to it now. It's about 15 years into the process, and there's no way that we're going back. There is no way. I think that the challenge is going to be when people talk about recovery, particularly for providers, the professionals in the system, up here the lingo is, and I agree with you about words and what happens with words,
mm-hmm.
How they can be co-opted, etc. And there's this, everybody wants to say we're recovery oriented now, and are they simply going to, I just say, tweak the system, or is there going to be real transformation in the system, which really it will shift away from the paternalism and really shift away from the medical model to where there's peer support, self-help, wellness tools, and it's prevention and mental health promotion. To me, that's what recovery is mental health promotion, and that is to me, that would be that's what I hope, that's what I'm working towards as my goal, and having a critical perspective of the system and being able to listen to the stories and what people say, the people who have been able to recover despite the system, and for us to be able to have that information and so that we can help ourselves. And we're not going back. But it's a question of whether we can make it into that that changed place or not. So,
well, it's a long road to Tipperary, I tell you that.
Yeah, we have to do it.
I think, like I said, the impetus is there. There's a lot of darkness that has to be traveled through because there's so much fear. And like I said, there's a lot of ignorance about this model that has to be put out there. If you can get the buzzword personal medicine out there and Oprah picks up on it, you know, somebody's got to carry the flag here. Just to get above the impersonal medicine that's been going on over the last 50, 60 years, you know, a somatic guy like me, I'll be leading the band for you because I just want to free the SAPES and have them understand that they have first-person authority. And the minute they give up that first-person authority,
yep.
They lose that coherence, they lose that relationship with their surroundings, and their environment becomes a threat rather than a support system, and then they start to become reactive and dysfunctional, and there comes the label police.
Yep.
You know, so I just, thanks for, I mean, that. If anyone wants to know more about it, you can go visit her at cultureofrecovery.org, and do you have an 800 number or a phone number you can give out, or?
Well, I just need to mention with our website, it's a work in progress right now, and there will be lots more information hopefully in the next couple of months or so going on that, and just sharing as many resources as we can. So, and we don't have a 1-800 number at this. We have no, you know what? We're totally grassroots. We do not have funding. We don't have government funding to do this.
Wow.
It's totally coming from grassroots, so.
Well, there's certainly a need, but go visit the website because there's a lot of contact information up there. I'm sure Anne will correspond with you like we found her.
Yep.
And there's, like I said, this is one of those things where it's going to have to come from the kitchen table. People are out there suffering needlessly, and you're a beacon for that kind of a suffering mass out there. And I just wish you luck with this because it's not an easy road, but it's the one you're on. So, play good music while you're traveling there.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks
for joining
us.
This experience. So
no problem. We'll get you the MP3. You can spread the word over and over again.
Okay.
So thanks
great.
For joining us here on Summertime. Have a good night.
Thanks, and Mark. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take care now. All right. Wow. Dusting off my first solo voyage here. Wasn't that bad? Wasn't that painful, guys? You know? What do you think, Tom?
I got a bad liver and a broken heart.
That's right. So next week we're actually going to be talking to another Canadian. This is getting a little nutty. Who runs an experiment that's called Soma Labs, and he's looking at a bunch of different modalities and how we're able to integrate these different maps. And I'm really excited about that. His name escapes me at the moment. I'm going to look it up because you can't stop me. And he's going to be an interesting discussion because he's also kind of a student researcher kind of guy, so he's really, like, you know, getting the facts down for us.
And it knows exactly what the fax is, as our friend would say. Let's see here. What's his name? He's got a weird name. I'm just going to pull it up here. Matthew Van Der Giesen. Hey, Der Giesen. So he'll be on next week. And then 2 weeks from now, we have the lovely and talented Frank Mosca talking about his work in optimism. And he teaches a course in optimism. So maybe we can unite the recovery people with Frank's work in 2 weeks. And in the middle, have a little Soma Fest, you know. So, you know, I will leave you now with the Mets up by 5 runs. They had a little rally there while we were talking. And, you know, it was an interesting kind of a way to go about the show tonight. We're going to have some different guests coming on. Might even have some guest clients coming on the show talking about the Somatic Method, which you can visit over at somaspace.org. We welcome you over there at the store, too. Go to the Soma store. Check out a little emotional makeover yourself with our lovely and talented Somatic Companion audio program. Spend 30 days with me in your ear, if you can dare. And I will be able to demonstrate to you that you do not get angry. Angry gets you, as it got me the other day. That's why President Val is no longer with us. So let's see.
He's alive!
That's right. So, you know, I guess had I done this...
A judo, what's up?
She might have joined us tonight, but, you know, we don't know. Like I said, we're in a transition phase here at Soma Time. So next week, like I said, we got that Soma Lab guest and Frank Mosca in a couple of weeks, and who knows after that. We got lots of people coming up in the pipeline, and I just want to get more participation from you and the listening audience. So email us at nakedsoma@gmail.com with your questions, comments, contributions, suggestions for guests. I don't care. And we'll get them on here, because we got an hour every week to kind of toss this stuff around. And then we go right back out to living our lives. So, you know, as we head into the holiday weekend, and we got a full moon tomorrow, and it's a big one. It's pretty much the first one of the spring, and it deals with anger in the past, resentment. So if you've been feeling that this week, you're right on course. Oh, boy. And it'll pass, and then it'll be Eco-Easter. Which is nice. So we get the emotional support from La Luna, La Bella, this weekend. So you know, I just wanted to just thank everybody out there. We've been doing the show like 2 years, at least 2 years, and it's been, you know, like I said, a process for me. It's not something I have any training in. It's sort of on the job. So more callers, more comments, more participation. I'm here by myself. We get the guest every week for you here. And we'll be back next week. So I'm going to continue this little theme, play us out with a little Joker, and we'll see you next time. Happy Passover and happy Easter, everyone. We'll see you here next week. Oh, one more thing. I'm going to be a guest on the On Purpose show, which is offline, with the chiropractors on Tuesday. They're going to be recording me talking about vitalism. So remember, I'll bring that up when we're talking with our Soma Lab guy next week. But just go to Google and put in the word vitalism, and a little dash, and put Life University. There's a conference coming up. I'll try and remember to put that up on blogsoma.net, the blog we love, this weekend. You can check that out, because it really kind of gives what we've been talking about with Ann here and this personal medicine concept a philosophical home. I want to make sure we get that across tonight as a kind of a bridge in the business to kind of connect these two topics this week and next week. So, all right, guys, thanks for joining us here on Soma Time, and I want you to, thanks for this time and your space, as I say sometimes. And I just wanted, this is Dr. Mark saying, be yourself and be well. Travel light, yada, 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 yada.
I'm a midnight toker. Give my love and on the run.
Ooh. Good night, Val.
Show you a good time, 'cause I'm a picker.
I'm a midnight toker. I give my love and